Hi, you're watching a very special episode of Agenda Awani, broadcasting from the sideline of from the sidelines of Islam and Liberty Network's 10th international conference with the theme Peace and Prosperity in Muslim Majority Countries and Beyond. Now, discussions focus on Muslim majority nation states and how they would be or strive to be peaceful, inclusive, and economically well-developed countries through the lens of democracy, civil society, economic freedom, peace, development, and also inclusion. I have with me today three renowned guests to discuss about this. First is Mr. Ali Salman, the CEO of Islam and Liberty Network, or ILN. And Lord Syed Kamal is a member of the House of Lords of the United Kingdom and also ILN co-founder. And lastly, Mr. Amin Ahmad is the ILN advisory board member. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Maybe I'll start with Ali. Tell us what the conference is about and why we need to have a special and separate conference for Muslim majority countries. How are the challenges for countries such as Malaysia unique compared to other countries?
So our network, Islam and Liberty Network, is focusing on Muslim majority countries because we see that in societies where Islam is invoked as a religion, as an example for principle of policy, principle of constitution and system, the understanding of Islam has consequences for economic, political, and rule of law regulations and systems. So we believe that bringing back this conference to Malaysia, which is a model country within the OIC member countries for economic development, for religious diversity, and representative democracy is important.
Lord Kamal, so I guess one of the pillars, if you can call it that, is liberty, as Ali mentioned just now. But the very notion of liberty seems to trigger the image of immorality and impiety. Why is this belief still around, especially when talking about Islam?
I think that's one of the challenges of using the word liberty and freedom as well. It doesn't mean unfettered freedom or liberty. You also have to be consider your fellow man or woman or your neighbours. And one of the things that people quite often misrepresent liberalism and liberty on is a very selfish individualism. Mm-hmm. It is not selfish individualism. We all care about our neighbours. We all care about our friends. Very few people are actually individually selfish. You care about your family, you care about your community, you care about your neighbourhood. But what we also have to remember is that it means that you should be free to do what you want, as long as you don't impinge on the liberty of others. And there shouldn't be coercion involved. In societies where there's less coercion, there tends to be more prosperity, but not just material prosperity, but also human flourishing. And I think that's one of the important things to remember. It's not unfettered. There are restrictions. I shouldn't be free to do whatever I want to my neighbours, but I should be free to do whatever I want as long as I don't impinge on their liberty either.
Okay, so Mr. Amin, still a bit, still not used to not being able to call you a YB after so many years. But Mr. Amin, when you talk about inclusion, you talk about untethered freedom or liberty. The challenge to Malaysia is quite unique. The question is, when you talk about inclusion and inclusiveness, how far can you go in Malaysia with regards to different beliefs, different ways of life?
I think from my experience involving in Malaysian politics, I guess many of us here is always like to try to set the boundaries from the beginning. Right. But I have a different approach or maybe different opinion about how we should approach this, because after all this while, we are seeing that the deterioration of the social cohesion in the country, and we are not moving anywhere because we are not open enough to really discuss what matters for people from diverse plural society in the country. We should be honest about what we feel and what we can do to be better. So when we talk about liberty as the principal values that should guide of our community, we should allow enough space for people to express their opinion, their cultural, and of course, including their faith and religion.
What do you mean, though, when you refer to the differences? Do you mean political differences, conservatism, liberalism? Do you mean sexual orientations? What do you mean with regards to Malaysian society?
Of course, Malaysia, we gain independence with a notion of Islam as a state religion or official religion of the country, and like it or not, majority views that Islam should be the framework, or should be the definition of how our society should be arranged. While at the same time, we must also appreciate that our founding fathers also acknowledge the existence of the other religions and also other cultures, and we should let the discourse open and let the societies rearrange what they feel should be or maybe should be improved in terms of policy, because sometimes we see our policies and leaders are quite open enough, but culturally our societies act maybe a bit further than what is guaranteed by the constitution.
Right. Yeah. Lord Kamal, contrasting the UK with Malaysia, obviously the two countries have similarities and also differences. I mean, riding on what Amin said, here the feeling is still that Islam should be dominant and should dictate almost every aspect of life. Can that exist in a country while at the same time not being overbearing or intrusive or insensitive towards other faiths?
Hmm. I think it's really, really important that I have to be very careful as someone who's not Malaysian, who, you know, is my second visit here, to make a judgment on the Malaysian system, because we all have different histories quite often, and the political system we have is an evolution of our past, and we have different histories. What's interesting in the UK is that we are theoretically the king is the head of the Church of England, but in reality, in many ways, we are a secular society. I think the challenge for all our societies, and particularly those of us who are Muslim or someone of faith, is how do we make that separation between our personal sphere of morality and the public sphere of morality? So, for example, you know, I don't drink alcohol, there are lots of things I don't do, but I would not ban others from doing so, for example. And we've seen this in countries such as here, you know, such as here. There's not that ban on some certain things. I think the challenge really is the sort of live and let live attitude. How much do you allow to continue? And I think it's very difficult for me to say the Malaysians should do it like the British. It's like Malaysians coming to Britain and saying the British should do it like the Malaysians. I just think we have to understand the context and the development and the history. One of the things I think we can have in common is our diversity in our countries, and the fact that as long as we can respect each other's differences and we make sure that we do that in public life, hopefully that will reduce many of the tensions that there might be. And in fact, we all have things in common. We may be from different communities, different faiths, but we all care about the same things. We all want a clean environment. We all want to live in a safe society. We all want to be, in some ways, materially, but also personally, prosperous. And that doesn't matter what faith you are, what belief system you have. And so sometimes we have to look at our commonalities between different communities rather than assume that we're all different because we come from a different faith or different ethnic background.
Right. Mr. Ali, I guess that's interesting because, yeah, you have these overarching themes. You have peace and prosperity. You have key pillars and principles that you talk about in this conference, in fact, every year. But the reality is every Muslim majority country is different, as Lord Kamal mentioned just now. So it has to be fitted to each society, each demography. And Malaysia is indeed a very diverse and in some ways challenging demography in society. So what do you see the challenges for Malaysia are in actually implementing the Islamic way of life without being intrusive, without being overbearing or insensitive or even oppressive towards other faiths?
So first of all, I'd like to share that we ascribe and subscribe to a universal understanding of these institutions. And I agree that each country has a different history in terms of economic and legal and political evolution. But ultimately, if we look around the world, whether Muslim majority countries or other countries, the countries who have provided a degree of openness to their societies, whether in terms of freedom of expression, doing business, or and political institutions, they have developed more and they have offered greater economic opportunities. And in this respect, I think Malaysia, as I said, happens to be one of the better models within the OIC member countries. Malaysia has its own example. Malaysia has its own challenges. And those challenges, one of the challenges is to deal with the racial diversity. And I think an optimistic conclusion of me having lived here for some years and worked in Malaysia is that democracy is an important tool and institution to manage these differences, which Malaysia has exhibited successfully, that these differences have been negotiated in a non-violent manner. Now, if you look in many other societies in this region or other parts of the world, unfortunately, and particularly in Muslim majority countries, we see a lot of conflict, we see a lot of poverty. And if you just look one important statistics, for instance, the refugees population in the world, 80% of the refugee population currently come from Muslim societies. People are afraid or they are not finding economic opportunities in their own societies, and they have to seek refuge in other societies. So in that respect, while Malaysia offers example, I think there are these universal values that we are hoping that all countries should adopt.
But how do we achieve that? Can we achieve that without compromising or discounting some aspects of the religion, for example? I'll give you an example. Sharia law, hudud. If you want to achieve healthy multilateralism in a country, it's inevitable that you have to make concessions on some key principles of the religion. I think Amin would know how difficult it has been for some quarters to push hudud or Sharia law in Malaysia. So is it inevitable that in catering to every segment of society, there will be differences, and therefore some concessions have to be made even with the basic values or basic pillars of the religion?
So if you look at Islamic history, I think we have a very good example in the form of Misaq-e-Madina. The charter which Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam signed between Muslims and non-Muslim community of his time, where the idea of equal citizenship was offered and was implemented while respecting the individual rights and while respecting the faith of other communities that was delivered. And I think if you look at recent history of Islamic civilization also, you find that it is possible to live in harmony while respecting our individual social systems. So I think that it is not just possible, but it has been demonstrated through our history that we can live with peacefully, we can respect other opinions without imposing our own worldviews on others.
Right. So we can see this in other countries as well, Lord Kamal. The recent Abaya ban in France. Do you see that as an example of healthy cohesion, taking into consideration the sensitivities and the values of everyone within that society? Or do you see it as religious intolerance?
It's a very difficult situation, I think. And I think one of the things I'm always very careful of is it should not be top down. I think it has to be in many ways bottom-up, but also there should be a great deal of mutual respect. And so in a society where people have freedom, religious freedom, you should be free to practice your faith, but you should also be free to not practice the faith if you want to, and without imposing one faith on the others. Now, of course, the French have got a very strict separation of state and faith. Sometimes people will call it fundamentalist secularization, trying to impose secularization. Now, I completely understand why this is a difficult issue for some of the other communities, particularly the host communities in France. And we have the same issue in Britain. You know, we don't ban things, but we leave it up to the individual. Now, I meet, for example, Muslim women who, some of them wear hijab or some of them wear a veil, and some of them say that they do it because of social pressure and family pressure. Others, and actually they don't like it. And there are others who say, I do it as an expression of my Islam and my faith, and I want the right to do that. I think trying to impose that from above cannot capture all of that. And so I think it's really important that as much as possible in society, we leave people free to practice their faith, as long as they're not imposing their views on others. And there will always be challenges in that. So for example, if you are a woman wearing a veil, there will be some circumstances, for example, for identification or for official documents, where you're going to have to remove that veil. Now, if someone says to me that I'm oppressed by my family and I have to wear a veil, it's very difficult because I can't then say, okay, we should use a law to tell your family not to force you to wear the veil. But as much as possible, I think it can be about mutual respect. And there will be challenges. I'm not saying this is easy, but I think if we've got that fundamental mutual respect, that's much better, I think, than top-down imposition of values on people in certain countries. But we may have a French politician here who would then say, I completely disagree with you. So I understand that as well.
Right. I mean, the question or the challenge in Malaysia is... right now is how much can we talk about the faiths or the community's issues and problems, which has surfaced a lot in recent political campaigns, as I'm sure you're aware. And the government seems stricter on banning some forms of speech regarding religion, regarding royalty, regarding race. So where do you stand on the question of being able to talk about one race or one religion's issue and not to the point that it becomes seditious?
This is maybe quite a grey area for many people because as a Muslim and coming from also a Malay race, I don't feel restricted by the government, not because I'm with the government, because I think in many ways I have like minority views about the Malay and also Muslim issues. I think the most important thing about the free speech is when we should be able to distinguish that from the hate speech. And we, as a government that govern the country, we must be careful of, especially in Malaysia, with a multiracial and with a lot of historical baggage that being carried and for many decades, to monitor the tendency of the people to stir up, prejudice among race and religion. Because when the clash or the tension is being heated without control, maybe we will end up being worse than what we have now. I think the issues of race and religion can always be brought up by anyone and with, maybe carefully chosen words or angle. I discussed a lot about this with Ali Salman before this. I mean, how we can frame that. I think all leaders, regardless of the party and from different blocs, can agree. Let's say, like for like Malay poverty among the Malays. Why don't we highlight it more of pressing issues that can be agreed and can be worked on together instead of like propagating divisive campaign or messages. I think leaders should be more responsible. And of course, having said that, I'm not saying that only one part have to play a role. I mean, government as a group of people who are holding powers must show example and should play more proactive roles. I mean, in influencing and encouraging people for a healthy discussion. But we should not resort to the banning of free speech as a first measure and to push the agenda.
Right. Yeah. You kind of led into my next question, because we have a few minutes left. I want to switch over to the economy, Mr. Ali. So how can Muslim majority nations work together better to achieve better, healthier economic development?
So if you look at the overall situation in terms of economic freedom, economic development in the OIC Muslim majority countries, according to international indices, they are, most of them as a bloc, are considered, unfortunately, unfree countries, which means that the role of the central government in economic functions is extended, and there are limitations on the private enterprise, and there are limitations on free trade, with some exceptions, of course. And I think the best way of increasing economic cooperation is to increase free trade, which of course is not aligned with religion, but free trade means that, you know, you are allowing the citizens and firms to do economic transactions with minimum government interventions.
Free trade is not aligned with religion. What do you mean?
So the free trade has to, I mean, it's not, there are some tendencies within the OIC countries, for instance, that the economic cooperation within the bloc should increase. But I'm saying, while Islam favors free trade and open market policies, the free trade follows the competitiveness of these countries. So I think in terms of increasing economic cooperation, we need the openness, we need more competition, and we need to encourage the innovation in these societies. And that's how you can reduce the poverty and you can improve the level of economic development in these societies.
What do you make of the criticism that the OIC has been a bit passive in recent years in terms of advancing the interests, including economic interests, of Muslim countries?
So my view is that since its foundation, OIC leadership has been focused on just managing conflicts within the Muslim societies.
Firefighting,
correct. And they have not developed a vision where economic prosperity comes in, where these issues of the innovation, the competitiveness is regarded due space. And that's why even today you see in the resolution of OIC countries, you see a lot of references to war, to conflicts, and that's the view which is restricting development in many of our societies. That needs to be changed, and we need to set new priorities focused on economic prosperity, focus on rule of law, focus on improving transparency and liberal democracy as well.
Lord Kamal, I know the UK is not part of the EU anymore, but you were for a good number of years. What pages can OIC take from the book of EU in terms of fostering more effective cooperation?
I think the challenge, if you look at the European Union, it was always about political integration. The hope was one day that there will be, if you look at the founders, Schuman and Monnet, they wanted to see eventually a federal republic of Europe or United States of Europe. The lesson there, though, is you've got to make sure that the elites in Brussels do not fall out of touch with the people on the ground. I mean, for example, I speak to many of my French friends. They tell me there was a referendum in France. Even President Macron admitted it. He said if there was a referendum in France, the French would probably vote to leave. And what's happened is you've seen a massive division by being supranational. Sometimes the national politicians can be quite distinct from the people, or the elite can be quite distinct. You're even further from these supranational organisations. Now, the interesting thing is that the OIC really hasn't developed. You know, I teach international organisations in the university, and you look at the OIC, it's not seen as a significant intergovernmental organisation in any way. It's seen more as a talking shop. Maybe that's not a bad thing, it stays like that, but it would be quite a good thing if it could move on beyond conflict resolution, as Ali says, to maybe think about how the countries can get together to make sure that their societies are more prosperous. Maybe they could mutually trade with each other much better, reduce those barriers, and give their consumers more choice, but also more value, if that makes sense, and their money can go further, and they can be more prosperous. But of course, it's a challenge, and the OIC itself has to think about what it wants to be as an organisation. I don't think it's really worked that out.
Right. We have a few minutes left. I want to go for a quick question and answer for all of you. The same question. I'll start with Amin. Amin, what do you think and hope this year's conference will achieve beyond dialogue?
I think the objective of our conference is to bring together, especially Muslims from all over the world, to discuss new ideas. How that a country can prosper and progress. And as I mentioned in my speech earlier, that Muslim countries have diverse political systems, and we believe that each country can learn from each other and help to strengthen cooperation at many levels based on respective influence that they bring from different delegates. And the progress can only be measured maybe after many years, right. But the seeds can be planted here.
Right. Yeah. Lord Kamal?
Yeah, I think it's really important to recognise that you can't bring change overnight. You have to plant the ideas, and sometimes they take a very long time. I think of the UK and the think tank I work for, the Institute of Economic Affairs. In the 1950s, they said it was crazy that you have a monopoly post office running your telephone service. Everyone thought that was a stupid idea. Of course post offices have to run, and of course there can only be one telecoms network. Right. They put the idea down. It took maybe for some country 30, 40 years until you had private competitive telecoms, but no one would want to go back to one post office running your telephone service. It just shows you have to put the ideas down, you have to put it down on the agenda, and you have to discuss them and hope that those ideas are shared. And there's nothing inherently anti-Islam about ideas of freedom and liberty.
Right. Mr. Ali?
So I think beyond the dialogue, this conference, I'm hoping, will generate new partnerships, will strengthen the network, and will create new specific project opportunities where we can learn from each other. For example, one of the key themes in today's session has been talking about the economic reforms in Tunisia, which is the only Arab country with successful democratic experience. Mm. And we hope that by bringing the experience from, let's say, Malaysia, from Turkey, we can bring those examples and convert these discussions into concrete action plans, into policy reforms roadmap, which these intellectuals and researchers can go back and discuss further in their countries.
Thank you so much, Mr. Ali Salman, the CEO of ILN, Islam and Liberty Network, Lord Syed Kamal, member of the UK House of Lords, and also ILN co-founder, and Amin Ahmad, the ILN advisory board member. Thanks so much for watching Agenda Awani, and I'll see you soon.